everyone, welcome to this episode of the New Voices podcast. I'm Joanna Chu, recording from Vancouver, Canada. And my guest today is Yilin Wang, a Vancouver-based writer, editor, Chinese-English translator, educator, and cultural consultant who was longlisted for the 2020 CBC Poetry Prize and a finalist for the Far Horizons Award for Short Fiction. She has an MFA in creative writing from UBC and is a member of the Clarion West Writers Workshop. We met when I first returned back to Canada from living in Beijing, and Yilin had actually brought together a group of writers to talk about racism in Canadian literature circles, including barriers to publishing and a need for safer spaces. And when I was an editor at the Toronto Star, I worked with Yilin on a very moving piece they wrote after the death of Weisen Choi, one of the first successful Chinese-Canadian authors, and how he showed that Chinese immigrants and their descendants could also be writers. Welcome to the New Voices podcast, Yilin.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And where are you recording from?
I'm recording from Richmond.
Oh, okay. And that's a city in Metro Vancouver that's, I think it's like half of people of Chinese descent.
Yeah, I moved to the neighborhood recently, so it's been a change from kind of living in Vancouver to be around more of the Chinese Canadian community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you enjoy that so far?
Yeah, I do.
So we're going to talk about your work in this podcast because it's so interesting, everything you do when it comes to things like fantasy fiction, Chinese folklore, martial arts, literature called Wuxia, which you'll tell us more about, diaspora identities, gender and migration, cultural reclamation, like all the topics you work with, I think, have so much resonance to our members and listeners. So thanks for joining us today. And actually, thanks for writing for us, because our website, one of our most popular stories in recent months is your five poems translations of Chinese revolutionary and feminist Qiu Jin. So we'll talk about that later in the podcast as well. So before we get started, we've opened each pod since the pandemic with some self-care recommendations. How have you been taking care of yourself, or what kind of struggles, and how are you trying to just, you know, be healthy?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and also something I've been asking other people too. Something I've been doing for myself is kind of reviving my meditation practice every morning, because I find it to be hard to, I think, feel, you know, kind of calm and de-stress and kind of focus with everything going on in the world. So that's something that's been really helpful for me, just to kind of take some time for myself, to kind of be kind of quiet and alone with my thoughts.
That's great. Like for me, I can't just meditate. Like my mind just races too much, I think. But I've made my yoga space more accessible. So it's just my mat is always there. And I do like 15-minute yoga videos in the middle of the workday. And I find that really helps. Sometimes I just feel so exhausted going from Zoom meeting to Zoom meeting, you know?
Yeah.
So really like having that break away from devices and talking to people really helps. Okay, so we'll get right into some of your work because we have so much to cover because you do so much. So can you just tell us about your background and how you became a creative writing professional?
Yeah, so I'm Chinese Canadian and I immigrated to Canada when I was 11. But I had also lived in the States for a while. And I started writing in my kind of mid-teens and kind of at the end of middle school, early high school years. And I've always been interested in storytelling, in literature, in languages. I think partially because of my grandparents being teachers, but also because I spent so much time kind of learning languages as an immigrant. So that's something that's always really interested me. And in high school, I started sending my work out, and that picked up more in university, where I ended up doing a creative writing degree and started writing a lot of fiction and poetry and nonfiction and just kind of working in different genres. And that's kind of how it started.
And then you did your MFA degree.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do a formal Master's of Fine Arts?
I felt like when I finished my undergraduate studies, I wanted to have kind of even more, spend more time immersed, I think, in the literary writing world. And for me, I think the easiest thing to do at the time was to kind of pursue an MFA because it is a common path for a lot of writers. It's not the only path, and I think there are many different options people can take. But for me, it was something that I wanted more of, and kind of to have access to the resources that a university has, and to be able to kind of take more workshops and kind of get more mentorship.
Mm-hmm. And you're currently part of the Clarion West Writers Workshop. Is this like a group of writers that work together and give each other feedback, or what is a writers workshop?
The Clarion West Writers Workshop is a professional writing, like a professional development program for writers of speculative fiction. They've been running for, I think, a few decades now, and many established speculative fiction writers came out of the program or are affiliated with it. So, so it's like a very established genre fiction workshop, and I'm taking part in it this summer. So I'm really happy to be part of that community and to work with a bunch of writers, including Ted Chong, who is teaching this summer.
Mm. And for those who might not know, speculative fiction is anything that deals with subjects that don't exist in reality. Is that correct? Like, so anything from fantasy to, you know, magical realism, anything supernatural.
Yeah, fantasy, science fiction, horror are kind of the common genres under that.
And so how much time do you spend on, like, your original work, and how much do you spend on translation work?
I think it kind of changes from week to week. Recently, I started doing more translation work within maybe the last 2 or 3 years. And so that's grown. And before that, I was doing kind of creative writing. And now kind of I'm finding a way to try to balance both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so different hats. Yeah. And may I ask, like, where originally is your family from or immigrated to Canada from?
Yeah, from Sichuan. So, so I'm Sichuanese heritage.
Mm-hmm. And were you fluent in Chinese growing up and spoken and written and reading? Or was that something you had to kind of develop when you were older?
I went to elementary school in China. So I was educated there. And so I spoke Mandarin and also the Sichuanese dialect. But I actually lost... I kind of forgot my Chinese because I also lived in the States when I was 5 until I was 7. And so there were kind of a lot of moving back and forth. So I had to kind of relearn Mandarin as well as kind of learn English again when I immigrated to Canada.
Oh, wow. Did you go to school? Like, how did you relearn, like, learn both languages at once?
Well, I learned Mandarin when I went back to China from the States. Because when you're 5, you know, and you move to a different country, and you live there for a few years, you're going to lose a lot of your first language. And I held on to my English, I would say, but not to the extent, you know, that I was using that all the time. And so when I moved here, then I had to, again, kind of learn English. And a lot of bilingual folks I know who are fluent in both languages often have this kind of experience.
Yeah, back and forth.
Yeah.
And I think, like, your work as a translator from Chinese to English, like, it means a lot to so many bilingual people who might be able to understand but not read, and you kind of help with translations to make Chinese works in Chinese accessible to a broader audience. So asking about literary translation, you've said in a recent interview that it's not just a process of bringing literary works into another language, but rather in an attempt to give literary works a new life while recreating them in another language. So it's kind of like an extension of creative writing, you said. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so I think when we speak of translation, people might think about, you know, machine translation, like Google translation, where you just substitute the words. But translation is actually not like that, especially literary translation, which gets much more complex. So for me, it's not necessarily just kind of the literal meaning that's kind of being translated, but rather you did translate and kind of convey the emotions kind of underneath and kind of the subtext. And kind of the internal logic and the context surrounding the work and kind of the emotional effects. So there are like lots of layers being translated at the same time, rather than just the literal words on the page. And that's, I think, something that I do as a writer as well, you know, kind of create a work while considering all of those things. So you have to kind of absorb the meaning from the original text and then kind of try to recreate that in another language.
And you've done translation of poetry, which I find just so difficult because I actually tried doing it on my own for an epigraph, like an introduction for my book. I was like, oh, it's only 5 lines. Maybe I can try it myself. But it was so impossible to translate it well for me as someone with no experience from Chinese to English, even though I knew literally what the words said in Chinese. It just making it into like a beautiful poem in English, it just takes so much skill. And how did you develop those skills to not just convey the meaning, but also for someone to enjoy the poem and get a sense of the, you know, kind of like the spirit and how it sounded in the original, as well as just be a new creation? Like, how do you learn how to do that?
Yeah, it's, I think I'm really lucky in that I come to translation from writing, because when I started doing translation, I didn't really have a lot of mentorship. And so I had to kind of figure out how to do it myself. And I started realizing that a lot of the work I do as a poet kind of still applies to translation, because just as mm-hmm. you said, you had to, you know, have a beautiful sounding poem. You had to kind of pay attention to word choice and sound and things like that. Skills that like a poet would use when writing a poem. So to be a good literary translator, often you need to have very strong writing skills in the genre and language that you're writing or, mm-hmm. or you're translating into. So a lot of it is kind of having those skills and being able to kind of express yourself in poetry, and then applying that and combining that with, I think, language skills. And then the other thing I think would be kind of close reading of the source text. I feel like I've never had to read so closely as I read when I translate, because you have to kind of scrutinize every word and think about why it is there, and have to put yourself in the author's head and imagine kind of like what did they mean and what did they intend with kind of every word.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of work that requires a lot of skills, including skills that a lot of people, writers, might have, including really strong language skills. Just a little bit on the finances of it. Do you make most of your money from translation, or is there a market for it? Do you get commissions, or do you kind of pitch projects to magazines or publishers?
There's been a lot of discussion about literary translation, unfortunately, being a field that does not pay well. So I don't make the majority of my income from literary translation. I have made kind of a bigger portion of my income from other types of translation, like just kind of translation for like arts and nonprofits and things like that. But literary translation itself, I think, just like a lot of creative writing, tends to be underpaid and undervalued. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in terms of projects, I would say a lot of the work is commissioned, but you can also translate work and submit it, just like you might write pieces or kind of query based on ideas and then get solicited to write a piece. So it's a mixture of both.
I guess it's pretty common for people in creative fields. They end up supplementing their literary creative work with commercial work. Yeah, so it's unfortunate that you have to juggle all of that. And you talk about your own projects, and it seems like you have an abundance of your own projects. In 2018, you spent months traveling around mainland China and Hong Kong to conduct research on the origins of the martial arts literature genre, wuxia. Can you tell us about that? Because you said before that you really try to immerse yourself in the world of, you know, the translation or your work. What made you decide to take like 3 months on a travel research trip? And what did you find?
Yeah, so this was during my master's. I was lucky to receive the opportunity to apply for a grant to do research overseas. And while I really enjoy kind of being in a creative writing environment in Canada, I did feel like given my interests in translation and my fiction writing, a lot of which is inspired by Chinese literature and folklore, I really wanted to take advantage of that and to spend some time overseas in China, where I can get kind of more exposure to the literary traditions that I'm inspired by. And that's a really, it was a really meaningful trip for me, and I really enjoyed it. And I spent several months basically backpacking around China with family members or with friends, and also visiting Hong Kong as well, and kind of looking at a lot of the sites related to wuxia, martial arts fiction, including doing work on like Jin Yong and his process, and like looking at manuscripts, but also looking at like museums and things like that, and also looking at like locales for kind of world building and kind of getting a sense of place.
And at the end of it, was it meant to like inform your work, like creating new wuxia like art and writing?
Yeah. So it was to help me kind of inform and kind of give context to start a novel project, and also for a collection of short stories, both of which I'm currently working on.
Okay. And for those of us who, you know, have kind of an inkling of what wuxia means, but not really sure how it came about in China, can you just give a little gist of the history and origins of wuxia and what it is?
Yeah. A common reference point I use for folks is Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which I think a lot of people have seen. It is a type of fiction that features kind of wandering heroes and martial artists who travel through this world called Jianghu, which is like this counterpart culture in ancient China that's like a liminal world where kind of people wander outside of the bounds of kind of conventional society and institutions, and kind of live outside of kind of the traditional kind of expectations people have, sort of like a Wild West of sorts. Yeah, so that's kind of how I would describe the genre. And the best known works of it came about in the 20th century in Hong Kong with authors like Jin Yong. But there's also an earlier tradition that can be traced back to like very ancient folk tales.
Mm-hmm. And it's basically, it's mostly fantasy, right? It's not meant to be like very realistic. So do people have like kind of, you know, watching all these martial arts movies, it seems like they seem to kind of be able to fly. do some of them have like powers like beyond being really good at martial arts?
I think it is kind of romanticized, and there are like, you know, subgenres. So one would be like xianxia, which is the magical one, where it's actually kind of people cultivating and they can fly on and kind of fly on swords and kind of just shoot clouds and have kind of magical powers of some sort. Whereas something like Crouching Tiger would be considered more realistic in quotation marks because it doesn't have anything that's like supernatural. But it's also like definitely pushing the bounds of the imagination.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of these works, do some of them have an element of like social commentary? Or like you've looked at some lesser known characters, like some like badass female characters. Are there kind of tones of kind of, you know, featuring people who might be pushing the bounds of, you know, social norms a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. Because the concept of Xia actually is kind of the character of Xia, which is like this kind of vigilante kind of figure, is rooted in its kind of opposition against society and kind of institutions and kind of norms. is someone who, you know, exists outside of those things. So oftentimes you're going to find in wuxia stories characters who are underdogs and characters who are marginalized in some way, including like women heroes and kind of cross-dressers, kind of folks from a lower social class background, that kind of thing. And so that's pretty common. And there is actually one short story or kind of like a flash fiction folktale that I translated that's on my website about like this woman kind of bandit leader who I think it's the first recorded story of a female like bandit leader in Chinese history. And as far as I know, it was never translated before, but I came across it and I found it really interesting. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. We'll put a link in our show notes so people can read it. What's the title of that short story?
It's called The Woman in the Carriage.
Oh, cool. I'm going to check that out. And what is your Zhanghu project? So Zhanghu is that space, you say, like this fantasy counterculture where wuxia characters, you know, roam and occupy, and it literally means rivers and lakes. So what is Zhanghu? Like, am I correct in describing what it is? Like,
yeah,
the space?
Yeah.
And what is your literary Zhanghu project?
Yeah. So the reason why it's called literary Zhanghu is because I wanted to allude to the wuxia tradition. And I think about literary Zhanghu as a project where I am trying to bring stories and kind of the history and tradition of wuxia into English so that more folks can be aware of it, but also to kind of highlight maybe aspects of the genre that people don't know as well. Because as I said, like Zhanghu is this counterculture that's kind of focused more on marginalized voices. And sometimes kind of Western understandings of wuxia can be very kind of surface level, just in terms of kind of associating Chinese culture with martial arts. And there's kind of so much more than that. So it's trying to address some of the stereotypes and trying to go deeper into that tradition.
And where can we find this work that you have?
Yeah, so there's a page on my website, just a literary Zhanghu page. And it features some of my research in the form of blog posts, as well as some of my translations and social media posts I've created. And I also have an upcoming article on the history of the wuxia genre that's probably going to come out in the next month or two with the Science Fiction and Fantasy Association of America, CIFWA, and their kind of industry publication.
Awesome. Very cool. And do you think speculative fiction in general is like a pretty like hot market right now in the publishing world?
I don't know what's kind of considered hot, or I think like trends come and go, but I think there has always probably been interest in that kind of work. Yeah, and I would say also, I think there's a long tradition of like writers of color working in that genre, because it is sometimes kind of seen as less mainstream than really literary fiction. And kind of the being able to, you know, imagine and kind of have kind of speculative elements and have supernatural things can kind of be freeing for some writers.
Mm-hmm. And shifting back to your poetry, does the work, the poem you wrote in English that was longlisted for a CBC Poetry Prize, a prestigious prize here in Canada, is called A Sichuan Diaspora's Daughter Kitchen. And you described it as subversion through cooking and dialect. Can you explain what you think is subversive about cooking and dialect? And I guess you're referring to the Sichuan dialect that you speak with your family.
Yeah. So I actually was thinking a bit about translation as well when I was writing this poem. Growing up as like a 1.5 generation immigrant, I often had to, you know, kind of negotiate this space of kind of being someone who is, you know, Sudanese, but also part of the diaspora and living abroad. And so I talk in this poem about, like, how to hold on to aspects of one's heritage in terms of, for example, like traditional cooking and kind of cuisines from home, and also kind of language and kind of words that are hard to translate, kind of dialects that don't have, you know, kind of easy translations, words that are just kind of difficult to bring into English, and then kind of trying to hold on to that. And I think that's kind of something when you juxtapose against me being in North America and me writing and translating into English, sometimes I'm kind of bringing those elements of myself into my writing in a way that kind of disrupts the English language, because they're not kind of things that kind of part of English.
Yeah, and your poem uses an example of hupi, la jiao, tiger skin, hot peppers. And is it kind of like a metaphor? Because you ask in the poem, like, how do you make this dish in a foreign land when these veggies have not yet grown roots there? Can you tell us a bit about this metaphor that you made?
Yeah, so one thing that I think about when it comes to cooking is, like, you know, sometimes you need very specific ingredients, right? I don't know if you've ever had this experience where, you know, mm-hmm. you're trying to make a particular kind of cultural dish or something like that, and then there are very specific things that you need to make that dish. And for me, since I spent time in Sichuan and am kind of really into the food, I know kind of how I kind of want certain dishes to taste like, and certain things that need to be included, but you don't necessarily have those things when mm-hmm. you're living in the diaspora. And so you need to, like, make substitutions and try to kind of get it to work. And that's also kind of like just part of that kind of living experience as well. So I would say it's kind of connected also to translation and just to kind of being an immigrant.
Yeah. So you talk about, like, a theme seems to be, like, going back and forth between cultures and languages, being an immigrant. When it comes to actual act of translation, what do you think might often get lost in translation, like, literally, particularly between English and Chinese?
Yeah, I think sometimes what's hard is maybe the cultural context. Because I think we can all, you know, translate again, like, the words and the events and the characters and so forth. But things like, you know, contextual things might be harder to explain. And for example, recently I translated a short story that had humor in it and also kind of like wordplay and puns. And so, you know, Chinese, like Mandarin, is a language that sometimes has a lot of puns and, like, homonyms and stuff like that. But that's kind of does not necessarily translate into English. So how do you kind of deal with those kinds of things?
And how do you deal with it? Like, it's kind of clunky to have a bunch of footnotes. So what are some solutions?
Yeah, for that story in particular, I ended up kind of trying to preserve a lot of the sound. So I kind of used loan words and kind of brought in the original characters in the form of pinyin into the story, so that hopefully readers in English would get to experience also the pun that Chinese readers do. And then I ended up having to kind of integrate a bit more kind of explanation of how kind of it plays out.
And how do you know you've done a good job? Because, you know, it can be endless, like, it seems like, the process. And many writers, if you're translating them, they can't read English or can't read English very well, or maybe they're dead because they're historical figures. So how do you know that you've done the original translated work justice?
Yeah, I think this is really hard because it is kind of subjective. And I think we do need to realize that a translation is never going to be exactly 100% the same as the original, like, because it is a translation. So I think what you can do is just try your best to capture the spirit of the work sort of going back to what I mentioned earlier, like not just the literal meaning, but also kind of the deeper intentions and effects that are kind of intended by the piece. And with living authors, I'm lucky in that I can often communicate with them, which helps a lot, where I will try to ask questions to kind of clarify certain passages that might be ambiguous, to try to kind of understand where they're coming from and to kind of have them participate in that way. But obviously with dead authors, you're not able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you ever get other translators kind of proof your work or give you feedback on it?
Yeah, it's pretty common to have someone kind of review, and there are a few poets and poetry translators who I kind of swap work with.
I guess you can debate some things for a long time.
Yeah.
At the end, I guess it is your voice. Or is there any work that you're interested in translating next?
I'm looking at translating some contemporary women poets. Currently, I'm in touch with a few and have been reading through their work, so I'm excited about that. And I'm also putting together an application for a grant to translate a book-length collection of Chiu Jing's poetry. So we'll see what happens there.
So Chiu Jin, so that was what I mentioned at the beginning, the revolutionary Chinese feminist, a pioneering feminist. She seems like really interesting reading her bio. Can you tell us a bit more about Chiu Jin?
Yeah, so she's often described as the first kind of Chinese modern feminist, which makes her a very interesting figure. And she was a revolutionary who died in an uprising against the Qing dynasty. And she also wrote poetry and essays. And she also ran a publication, I think that's called like Women's Journal or something like that. And so she did a lot of different things in her short life. I think she only lived for maybe 31, 32 years. And she is someone who I think is very influential because of her work as like a woman writer.
Yeah, and she was interested in martial arts and horseback riding and sword fighting. Like, was she literally like a revolutionary fighter in an uprising?
Yeah, so yesterday I was doing some work and reading more of her biography in depth, and I actually came across this one sentence about how she was kind of nearly blew up her room trying to build bombs. So
wow. There should be like a movie about her.
There is a documentary, actually. So
okay,
people can look.
Yeah. And I see a photograph that you included with your piece for us of her wearing men's clothes. So she was also kind of ahead of her time in that way. Can you talk about her cross-dressing?
Yeah, so she was known to cross-dress, I think, after she moved to Beijing, where she was exposed to a circle of more kind of progressive and liberal circle of women, intellectuals. And she started doing all sorts of things like cross-dressing, wearing men's clothes, learning sword fighting, and kind of meeting them to talk about kind of feminist ideas and so on. And then she kind of continued cross-dressing. And I think it's a big part of how she viewed herself. And there's a poem I translated where she talks about wearing men's clothes. And in some circles, she's kind of seen as a trans icon as well because of that.
And would you say that an interest in feminism or social movements helps kind of motivate your work and your subjects?
Yeah, I would say so. I think I'm drawn to her work because of that.
Yeah, as is all of New Voices members, I'm sure. So let's talk about, you know, the reality of politics and power dynamics in the literary translation world, or more broadly, the creative writing world or literary and publishing spaces, which are notorious for being really like white dominated, if not white male dominated, just, you know, white dominated. And like we met because we were involved in talking about public awareness building work around racism in Canadian literature circles. Can you talk a little bit? I know it's a huge topic and you've written about it, so maybe you can refer us also to your previously written work, but about these power dynamics in the world that you work in.
Yeah, I think I wrote a piece 2 years ago in Carte Blanche that talks more about racism in Canada specifically, but I would say we are living in a world where there is, you know, a lot of ongoing oppression in different ways that is systemic, and we also see that present definitely in publishing, in writing, and in translation. So some of my work is trying to address those things in terms of advocating for more kind of support for marginalized voices. A few years ago, I witnessed some racism against a Chinese Canadian poet and translator reading in Mandarin, that kind of being described with slurs and stuff like that. And then later on, I started doing translation work myself. And I started realizing and kind of seeing more the same dynamics in publishing kind of repeating themselves in translation, where the field is very much dominated by white translators, often academics, often people who actually don't have any particular connection to Chinese culture or language in terms of kind of their heritage, and kind of just approaching it in a way that's very, very distant and kind of detached. And they're the ones who are often kind of given a lot of opportunities and kind of presenting at events and get upheld because of the way kind of publishing is. So one of my most recent initiatives has been kind of starting up some resources to encourage more translators of color to get into translation.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of initiatives?
Yeah, so I created this resource, SHU, Connecting with Other Translators of Color. It's a kind of like an online listing / database, SHU, like an Excel sheet, that has dozens of translators of color who are willing to give their time and mentor and kind of share advice and resources with kind of emerging and aspiring translators.
Mm-hmm. And is there, like, at New Voices, we have a directory of over, I think, 600 minority, non-binary, and female China experts in different fields. Is there a list of translators of color that we can include in this directory that, or we can refer people to if, you know, someone's looking to commission a translation and wants to support a writer of color who has some sort of connection to Chinese culture?
Yeah, so I would say right now there is no listing that I know of in terms of just translators of color. There is an organization called ALTA, which is the American Literary Translators Association, and they have a kind of branched off organization that I'm part of, which is the BIPOC Caucus. And it is a collective of BIPOC literary translators. And I think we have over 100 members. And so oftentimes people will reach out to us. So I would say maybe look out for the BIPOC Caucus and look for just kind of literary translators in the community, maybe who are kind of heritage speakers and BIPOC, yeah.
And if you're listening or you know of someone who is a BIPOC translator, please reach out to us at editors@newvoices.com and we can add them to our experts directory, which is quite popular and gets checked by lots of media outlets and event organizers pretty regularly. So we'd love to add more translators to that resource. Okay, so moving on to just one last bit about more of your upcoming work. You're working on a debut short story collection and poetry chapbook. Is this related to what you were talking about before or separate topics?
They're related.
Okay, so related to Wuxia and Qiujin?
Related to Wuxia. And then the poetry chapbook, the poem that was longlisted in the CBC Poetry Prize, that is part of that project.
Oh, I see. Okay. So talking about, like, we talked about power dynamics, we talked about how literary translators often are undervalued and don't get paid a lot. Can you tell us about your day-to-day realities of working as an independent writer and translator and poet? Having your level of success, like getting recognition, getting grants and things like that, it seems like it's still not very sustainable for writers even at your level. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think myself, I'm still pretty emerging. And I graduated last April, you know, right when the pandemic began. And so that, I think, poses some challenges on top of just freelancing as well. And I'm sure you know this too, probably from maybe past work in freelancing. It can be very unstable as a job, and work really fluctuates and kind of changes depending on kind of your current projects and so on. There are challenges around kind of chasing people down to get paid and that kind of stuff. And also sometimes just people kind of not valuing freelancers, their time and work kind of as well as they should. For example, people asking for free labor and that kind of stuff. And then also the lack of benefits around being a freelancer because you have to kind of take care of everything yourself.
Yeah. And on top of that, being a BIPOC translator, you say like there's gatekeepers who people with more privilege often get the more cushy jobs and positions and things like that. That also plays a role.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So what can we do to try to change this dynamic and to support freelancers?
I think it's a systemic issue. And so I think it's going to need a lot of addressing in terms of the way that things are structured. I don't think it's like, you know, something that can be addressed by one person or fixed overnight. For example, the initiatives started by Black writers around, you know, publishing Paid Me kind of shed light on pay structures for kind of writers working in publishing. And I think those kinds of projects and kind of initiatives to kind of boost hiring and kind of supporting more writers and translators of color, but also getting more of them into positions of power where they can, you know, help kind of transform things from the inside, that would help. And also, I think just focusing on improving kind of working conditions as well.
Mm-hmm. And how about the awareness building process? It seems like anytime, like we've talked about this before the podcast, when you are a minority of whatever type of minority, often you get asked to do a lot of free labor in public awareness and education. Is there any way to get around that? Because some people really want to understand and support, but they come from a low level or lower level of understanding. What do you think about that dynamic where it can get exhausting for someone who's a minority already or marginalized to always be doing the advocacy?
Yeah, I think it is really tough. And I think, of course, we all want to do things to make things better, but it's also, it shouldn't only fall on, you know, the BIPOC and the marginalized folks in whatever way they're marginalized. And it should be kind of up to everyone. And we talk about the need to educate, but also there are already so many resources out there that have been created. And do people need to be kind of rehashing the 101 on, you know, diversity and inclusion when there are maybe kind of already many, many resources that people can consult? And yeah, like recently I attended a panel that was really great, and it was on kind of representation and translation because of kind of some racism against translators of color. And they talked about how it's a very important panel, but they also talked about how, like, they're always asked to speak on, you know, representational issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talking about, you know, financial realities, you recently ended up with a pretty big dental bill, and that doesn't really match with your writer's income. Can you tell us a bit about that experience?
Yeah. So I'm currently running a GoFundMe to raise money to deal with some emergency dental expenses that have come up. Unfortunately, it's just part of the reality of healthcare in Canada, where dental care is not covered. And even if you have insurance, it can often be very limited. And so due to some kind of wisdom teeth issues and other things happening, I'm in need of kind of emergency dental work. And so that's, none of that is kind of covered. And because I've had some other emergencies to deal with, such as kind of being renovicted in January and being forced to move in a pandemic, it's just been quite challenging. So I'm raising funds to help with that. And people have been really kind and generous and really, really helpful.
I guess people don't really think about Canada having a gap in our healthcare system, but definitely for some reason, dental is not covered in just being Canadian and living here. It can get very expensive. Are there any supports for freelancers? I mean, in the US, it's even worse, obviously, with freelance and insurance issues. Do you know of a resource where people, like some sort of fund or union that freelance writers, translators can try to join, or that people who want to support these people can support in donations?
I'm not sure. I know there, in, for example, I'm a member of, again, the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, SIFWA, and they have, for example, for their members, like a emergency medical fund, which I've applied for, but I'm not sure if I qualify, because even though I'm a member, I'm not in the United States. And there are kind of similar organizations in Canada, but as far as I know, none of the writer or kind of artist organizations have this kind of setup.
So I guess I would encourage our listeners, if you you know, support this kind of work, like things that Yulin is finding and translating that would might not otherwise get translated, there's different ways to support this work from happening, to continue to happen. So just to close off, what shows, books, or films have inspired you lately, Yulin, and your recommendations for our listeners?
Yeah, so one book I've been reading is called New Sense. It's a collection of speculative fiction by people of color, edited by Niecy Shaw. So that's something I'm really enjoying. And then also the nonfiction book Ace, which is about asexuality.
It's called Apes?
Ace.
Ace. Oh, great. Awesome. And I guess I didn't really come prepared with a recommendation of my own. What did I just finish reading? I finished reading a novel called Girls with Bright Features from someone who shares an agent with me. And it's a really good satire and kind of gripping, more fun read about the college admissions process and how it can be so grueling in the U.S. Yeah, it was kind of fun, but also important. So, and I also finished, or no, I'm not finished. I am part of the way through China, the novel by Edward Rutherford. It's a way to tell about 19th century Chinese history through a novel format. And I just interviewed him yesterday for a library event. And I was impressed by how he did a lot of diligent research and consulted Chinese academics and people to make sure he tried to get the details right. So yeah, those are interesting. And again, what's the best way to follow your work? Because you have such a large body of it.
Yeah, so people can check out my website, www.elinwatt.com, or follow me on Twitter, which is ElinW or ElinWriter.
You know, the supportive network, is that also on your website?
Yeah, there is a link to it on the resource page, I believe.
Well, thank you for your work, both you know, translating is really interesting works, as well as your work in the community to provide supports and resources in the community.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today. New Voices Podcast is part of the Seneca Network and powered by South China. This episode was produced by New Voices and edited by Jason McDonald. Music is by Wu Fei. Our website is newvoices.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at New Voices. We've launched a Patreon crowdfunding account to support our events, online magazine, podcasts, and trainings, and patrons are invited to play an active role in the org, including suggesting guests for future upcoming podcasts. So more information is available on our website or patreon.com/newvoices. Another way you can support us is by subscribing and leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you, and thanks for listening, and hope you all take care of yourselves.